Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Hey, true crime besties. Welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly. Hey everybody, welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly. With me, Annie Elise. We have got headline highlights today. As you can tell, if you are watching from YouTube, you can see I'm still in the hotel in Boston, so my background is a little bit different. I'm in the hotel room. It's also a little bit darker. I have my ring light. It apparently sucks ass, and so I'm going to try to get this recorded before the sun goes down. It's been a long day at court for the Karen Reed trial, so I'm just now getting back to my hotel room. Want to bang this out for you, give you all of the updates of everything going on this week in true crime, and let you know everything you need to know. Also, there will, of course, be a deeper Karen Reed recap that's coming out this Friday, where I'm breaking down what went down in the courtroom this week, some of my firsthand accounts and perspective, especially when it comes to the jury and their reactions, and more to come on all of that. Also, just in case you missed it, we did release a Diddy update on, what day was it? Tuesday on the podcast feed. It was outside of the normal release schedule, so you might have missed it, but you can go back and listen to it after this. And as a reminder, just follow the podcast if you're not already, because I am going to be putting out more Diddy updates as the trial continues, because I know you guys want to continue to remain informed about it. But don't worry, we also are going to be going through what's happening this week in the Diddy trial on today's episode as well, because I want to make sure that you guys are like in the know, that you have all the details for all the cases. So we're going to start with this first case, and it's about a mom who bought tactical gear for her son who was actually planning a mass shooting at a school. Now, you guys aren't ready for this story because it really, really is upsetting. I think that any of us who are parents and even non-parents can agree that school shootings are something that we always have to worry about. It's something that's like our worst nightmare in the back of our mind. I know for me it is. And it is just such a scary time right now because it seems like they are just increasing out there. So while all of these parents and the public is worried about school shootings, apparently, Ashley Pardo, a 33-year-old mother from San Antonio, Texas, was not having that fear, did not share that same sentiment. Because apparently, in January of this year, her 12-year-old son, whose name has not been released because he's a minor, he was caught drawing some very disturbing images at school. And these drawings included a detailed map of the school, something that he labeled as a suicide route, something that where he had written out the name of his school with a picture of a rifle next to it, and just very, very graphic, disturbing images. Now, the school staff talked to him about it, and they told him that this kind of thing obviously was not allowed, but that's really where they stopped it. They didn't do much else. They didn't really intervene at all. They kind of just gave him this little slap on the wrist. Then, in April, he was suspended because the school staff found searches on his school-issued device of the New Zealand mosque shootings. If you don't recall, that shooting occurred back in 2019, and it was a horrific tragedy where 51 people were killed. So as a result of the searches on his school-issued device, he was immediately suspended. So then allegedly, later that same day, he attempted to take his own life with a straight razor. Fortunately, he was unsuccessful. It didn't work. Yet he did inflict a significant enough amount of harm that he required 100 stitches. So sometime after this attempt, he ended up being sent to an alternative school. He also had been exhibiting a lot of erratic behavior, so he would then went to go live with his grandmother. So he remained enrolled at this alternative school until May 7th. But then on May 8th, he was allowed to return to his regular middle school, the one that he had previously been attending. The school even stated that they had put a new, quote, security plan in place upon his return back to the school. Which I don't know about you guys, but I would be super pissed if a student at my child's school was allowed to return back after all of these dangerous images that he was drawing, these plans that he was putting together. That would be enough for me to say, like, this kid should be freaking expelled, right? Now, I'm not sure if the school had a choice in the matter or what, but I can't imagine that any of the teachers or the parents were feeling very safe with his return. So then, just a few days after he returned, his grandmother discovered him in his bedroom hitting a live bullet with a hammer. Now, she was obviously alarmed finding him with a real bullet, and when she asked him where he had received it, where he got it from, he told her that his mother had actually taken him to go buy ammunition. And not just ammunition, as though it's not just like just that, right? But not just ammunition, but tactical gear as well. Probably not something that you want to buy your young teenage son who has already drawn these plans of like grandiose danger and violence, right? I don't know, just a thought. Thankfully, the next day, his grandma did end up doing a full search of his room. And that is when she made some seriously disturbing discoveries. She discovered a loaded rifle, a loaded pistol magazine, a homemade explosive device, which had a name written on it as if it was, you know, meant to target that specific person. And she also found notes that referenced mass shooters in addition to white supremacy materials, which, I mean, talk about like the mother load of disturbing stuff to find in your grandson's room or your child's room, right? I cannot even imagine how panicked she must have been in that moment. So thank God his grandma, she did not waste any time. She immediately called the San Antonio Police Department and she notified them of this horrific discovery. Then when the authorities arrived at the school, they found the boy off campus. He was wearing a mask, a camouflage jacket, and tactical pants. So because of that, the police immediately took him into custody. Then when the authorities brought the boy's mother in for questioning, she just seemed completely unconcerned by her son's fascination with violence. And not only that, but she allegedly expressed to the school that she supported her son. She had support for his, quote, violent expressions and drawings. The mother went on to admit to the detectives that she had even been buying her son ammunition and tactical gear, all in exchange for babysitting his younger siblings. Are you freaking kidding me? You're buying your son ammunition and tactical gear so that he'll watch your other children? I'm sorry, but I'm just gonna say it. I try really hard not to judge people. You are a deadbeat parent, in my opinion. Point blank, simple as that.
The juvenile's mother, Ashley Prado, had been contacted previously by police, the school, and CPS. She appeared to be dismissive and unconcerned with her son's behavior. Her behavior is not only dangerous, it's abhorrent, especially as a parent. We don't know if he was armed when he showed up at the school in tactical gear and a mask. So he may well have been, but we don't know that right now. But the mother assisted him in buying that tactical gear for him and bought ammunition, provided him with magazines and ammunition to load those magazines up. Well, I'll tell you one thing. There were some very disturbing things that were found inside the mother's house, that child's house, which also kind of was an indication to us that we needed to move very quickly. So
the mother, Ashley, was ultimately arrested on May 12th, and she was charged with aiding with the commission of terrorism. However, she posted a $75,000 bond, and she was released from jail the very next day. Which, personally, I don't think that bond should even be on the table for anybody who's being charged with terrorism of any kind, especially an attack that is targeted at children. It just seems a little unnerving knowing that this woman is, like, back out there in the community, because we're talking about someone who allegedly bought her 12-year-old son tactical gear, ammunition, also he could use that for his planned mass shooting. Like, how terrifying is that? Now, according to some online threads, Ashley has multiple swastika tattoos on her body, and she apparently worships Charles Manson. So, I don't know. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, whatever you want to say. Now, I can't really fact check that because, like I said, it was all stated in threads, specifically on Reddit, but If it's true, it's very concerning. So she's due back in court for a pre-indictment hearing on July 17th, and according to a recent press conference, police stated that the boy is currently still in custody at a juvenile detention facility. I'm just flat out speechless and absolutely infuriated at the fact that this boy's own mother was helping, was like complicit in this, was like aiding him. It's just horrible to think about. I mean, thank God the grandmother intervened and acted as soon as she saw something, because clearly this whole situation could have had a much different ending, a much violent, more violent ending, right? Now, let's move over into another case. And this is one that you might be familiar with, but there's been an update. So I did a deep dive on this case a few months ago, and I'll link it in the show notes, but there has actually been a major development in this case. And the case is the case of Annie Maciejewska and Alan Gould. So let me do just a quick high-level recap for those of you who are not familiar with it. But in 2017, Anna was 42 years old, and she lived in Malvern, Pennsylvania with her husband, Alan, also with their four-year-old son, Andrew. Now, Anna was originally from Poland, and she had moved to the U.S. back in 1997. She attended the University of Louisville, and that's where she was studying, and she studied mathematics. So her friends and her family all described her as this very sweet, very, you know, kind-natured person, but they also said that she was a bit of a pushover. She would never really stand up for herself. She just kind of had like this strong desire to be liked by everybody. So unfortunately, a lot of people took advantage of that. Now, the other thing that you need to know about Anna is that she was very much a family-oriented person. Just because she lived far away from her family in Poland, she never let it stop her from maintaining a close relationship with them, especially her parents. She made sure that she flew back to Poland every single year to visit them. And not only for her to visit them, but to let her son spend time with his grandparents. She always made it a point to fly back for special occasions too. So when her father's 80th birthday was coming up, Anna, of course, planned on going. She wanted to surprise her dad, actually, for his birthday. She told her mom about it and said, you know, don't tell dad I'm coming. I don't want to spoil it. So her mom was really excited about the upcoming visit and seeing Anna, seeing her grandson, all of it. However, only 2 days before her scheduled visit, Anna texted her mom that she was no longer able to come. She said she had some sort of work commitment that she was unable to get out of. And it was really unlike Anna, especially to cancel on such short notice and to do that over a text message. She didn't even call her mom to break the news to her. It just seemed very impersonal, really out of character, and really odd. So not only did Anna not go to Poland as she had planned, but she also didn't go to work for that entire week, which is weird because if you remember, she had told her mom that she had this big work commitment that was preventing her from traveling. Yet Anna's coworkers didn't even know that she canceled her trip to Poland. So then when Anna wasn't in the office, it didn't seem odd to them at all, you know? They were under the impression that she had gone to Poland after all. So nobody was worried about her absence and nobody felt the need to report it. So Anna was supposed to be back from her trip on April 3rd, but right before that, she sent a text message to her boss saying that she needed to take an entire extra week off due to this vacation or this trip. Now, this was very unlike her to just text her boss with no notice of this extra time off that she was going to be taking. Yet her coworkers just assumed that maybe she was jet lagged, maybe she needed extra time to recover, maybe there was something else. And remember, this wasn't a phone conversation. It was all done over text. So eventually Anna's parents did start to worry, not only because Anna canceled her trip at the very last minute, but also because she never even called to wish her dad a happy birthday. So then her parents began calling her, texting her, trying to make sure that she was okay. And finally, after a few days, she did send them a text message in Polish. It said, "Daddy, wishing you a happy birthday. We love you. Anna, Alan, and Andrew." However, the message did not put her parents' minds at ease because whoever sent this message clearly was not fluent in Polish. A native speaker would not have typed it out that way. It definitely looked like it had been somebody who translated it into Polish. So right away, her parents knew that this message was definitely not sent from their daughter. They knew that it was sent from somebody who must have been pretending to be Anna. And obviously, this really freaked them out. So they kept calling and calling and texting. They were determined to get a hold of her. And then finally, after days and days of calling, somebody did pick up her phone. But it wasn't Anna. It was Alan, her husband. And he explained to her parents that Anna was sick with a stomach bug. That's why she hadn't been calling. That's why she hadn't been going to work. She was just out of commission. He said she was too sick to talk and that she'd probably, you know, maybe be feeling better by Monday. They should call back then. But in the meantime, just let her rest. Now, her parents didn't know what to do because, remember, they literally lived across the ocean from their daughter. And even though they knew that there was something off about the whole situation, they kind of had their hands tied. It's not like they could just hop in the car and go check on her or, you know, do a quick little visit. So they waited. And then when Monday came around, they called back, just as he advised them to do. Now, mind you, at this point, it had been 2 weeks since the parents had received that broken Polish text message, and more than 2 weeks since they had ever actually spoken to Anna and heard her voice. So when they called that Monday morning, Alan once again answered the phone. But this time, instead of saying that Anna was sick or that she returned to work, he said that she was missing. He said she hadn't returned home from work and that he was very, very worried about her. So when her parents were like, okay, well, what did the police say? Alan responded, I haven't reported her missing to the police because I've been busy. I haven't gotten around to it yet. Which, are you kidding me? You haven't gotten around to reporting your wife is missing? That doesn't make any sense, right? So right away, Anna's parents called the local police and they reported her missing. And the police were kind of like, yeah, actually, we already know. Which was really, really interesting because, as it turns out, her husband Alan didn't call the police, but her coworkers did end up calling the police earlier that morning. They reported her missing and they requested a welfare check be performed on her. So over the course of the next few months, the authorities discovered some very telling things. They found divorce paperwork at the couple's home. They discovered that Anna had been enrolled in a divorce 101 class. And get this, they found a printout of a Google Translate message, the same one that Anna supposedly sent to her dad, which I gotta just say, that's pretty big in my book. That is like, what do you call it? A smoking gun? Like, why do you have a Google translated printout of a message from English to Polish if your wife sent the message and she is a native Polish speaker? It makes no sense. They also discovered Anna's abandoned car less than 2 miles from her home. Now, friends of Anna's told the police that Anna had desperately wanted a divorce from her husband, but they also said he refused. They said she was really unhappy in her marriage and that she and Alan strongly disagreed on how to raise their son. Now, on top of that, Alan had hired a defense attorney right away, like right out of the gate, and he became increasingly less and less cooperative with the police investigation. So now, over the past 8 years, Alan has remained the number one suspect, but police never actually arrested him. He stayed in his home, raising their son, and almost everybody believed that it all appeared as if Alan had essentially gotten away with murder. However, after a very long and tedious investigation, I am beyond happy to report that Alan was finally arrested this past week, on May 14th to be exact. Now, I have no idea why it took so long to arrest him. I'm assuming they didn't have enough concrete evidence, only a lot of circumstantial evidence. But I am just beyond happy for Anna's family. Now an arrest has finally been made. They can finally get answers. They can hold people accountable. And it just makes me so happy. I can't even imagine how hard it must have been for Anna's family just waiting for this moment for nearly a decade now. It is unbelievable. Her parents, unfortunately, are not in the best health. So I do hope that they can live to see the day when Alan is convicted of their daughter's murder, if he is the one responsible. And hopefully there's a family member who can take good care of her little boy. So I will keep you posted on this. Definitely more to come. Now, this next story is very haunting and disturbing because it's about a set of New Jersey parents that kept their daughter locked in a dog crate. Like, what is going on with the world? So this next story, as I said, is out of Jersey, where a couple by the names of Brenda Spencer and Brandon Mosley are being accused of truly unimaginable abuse of their 18-year-old daughter. On May 11th, this 18-year-old escaped to a neighbor's house. She was barefoot, she was broken, her head had been shaved, and she was absolutely terrified. She sat on her neighbor's couch and she could not stop crying, and she just started detailing the horrific abuse that she had suffered. Now, this 18-year-old girl, whose name has not been released for obvious reasons, told the detectives that this abuse began back in 2018. She said it started when her mother, Brenda, pulled her out from school when she was just in the 6th grade and started homeschooling her. She claims that she was then forced to live in a dog crate for a year. A fucking dog crate. She stated that then, after being released from this dog crate, she was then forced to live in a padlocked bathroom, all while being chained up. I mean, Evil, evil, House of Horrors, disgusting. Apparently, the parents even had this bathroom hooked up to an alarm system so that it would alert them anytime she tried to escape. Pure evil. She said that she was only let out of the bathroom whenever the family would come over to visit. At other times, she was locked and chained in an empty room, only leaving a bucket behind so that she could relieve herself. And as if that wasn't horrific enough, she also states that she was beaten with a belt and she was sexually assaulted by Brandon, her mother's boyfriend. Which my heart just breaks for this poor girl, because can you even imagine? I will never understand how a parent, the literal woman who carried you for 9 months and delivered you, could ever do this to her own flesh and blood. It blows my mind. Now, according to the authorities, the living conditions in the home were absolutely vile, which I think is to be expected, right? I can't imagine that they were like tidying up after themselves. So they found evidence that supported all of the 18-year-old's claims, just as she had described. And police, of course, again, paralleling with what she had described, they found a room that was rigged with an alarm system, chains, and of course, that bucket that she was forced to use to relieve herself. And in addition to all of this, the home was overrun with animals. And I feel like that's something we see in a lot of House of Horror type situations. They always have so many pets, so many animals. So here specifically, they had 4 Great Danes, 3 dogs, other dogs, I should say, a lizard, snakes, several birds, which you guys know how birds freak me the hell out, 2 hamsters, and 29 chinchillas. I'm sorry, who needs 29 chinchillas? Like, what on earth is going on? Now get this, there was also another child who lived in the home, as if it freaking can't get any worse, right? The other child is the 18-year-old's little sister, who is only 13 years old. The parents apparently also pulled this child from school as well, because they were afraid that she might tell somebody about her sister, about what was going on inside that home, you know, that she would tell a friend or a teacher or a trusted adult, hi, my mom and her boyfriend are making my sister live in a dog crate. So they were scared and they yanked her out of school. These parents, and I shouldn't say parents, because although he's the boyfriend, well, yeah, he is the one who's kind of taking care of her too. So, well, I'll say parent for the mother, but you know what? Here's what I'll say. This couple, truly diabolical by every definition of the word. According to their Facebook page, they also have 3 other children together, a 3-year-old boy and twin 5-year-old little girls. However, these children were not found in the home. So who knows where the heck they are? Hopefully they're safe. I just can't even imagine. And it reminds me, like I said, I know I've been dropping the term House of Horrors a lot in this segment, but it really reminds me a lot about a recent House of Horrors case that I discussed. It's out of Connecticut, where the stepmom, Kimberly Sullivan, trapped and allegedly abused her stepson for over 2 decades. And then she tried to say that it was her husband who was doing all of this, yet he had been dead for a year. It's just absolutely insane and disgusting. How adults do this to children, I will never understand. And how do you even begin to recover from something like this? I truly don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, years and years of the absolute worst abuse, physically, sexually, emotionally, mentally, everything. How do you rebalance and recover from that? I mean, thank goodness this 18-year-old was able to escape and she's finally receiving the help that she so desperately longed for, but it shouldn't have happened at all. And who knows if the 13-year-old ever had anything inflicted on her or if they were just kind of scaring her into silence. But this is my opinion. I think it was only a matter of time before, if it hadn't already trickled down to the 13-year-old, it was probably just a matter of time until it did. Either the 18-year-old was going to get too big, she was going to age out, she was going to fight back. I think that people like this, monsters like this, prey on vulnerable people. I mean, this started when she herself was in 6th grade, right? So I think it was only a matter of time. So the fact that she was able to escape, she quite literally could have saved her younger sister's life. And that is incredibly brave. Now, I have a couple other cases that I want to talk with you about. And then I also need to break down what else is happening this week in the Diddy trial, because Cassie's mom testified. There's more information that has surfaced that is just like, makes you want to barf. So we're going to get into all of that, but we are going to take just a quick second here and hear from today's sponsor. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video. All right, so now I want to talk to you about this case where a mom abandoned her two kids at the scene of a bloody car accident. And she did this all too selfishly, avoid getting a DWI. So a mom in Missouri named Courtney Brown was arrested around 7 a.m. on May 12th. And you will not believe what this woman did. I mean, it's truly sociopathic, in my opinion. So she was driving down the freeway when she suddenly just stopped right in the middle of the road. And this sudden stop, it caused a major four-car accident. All of the drivers involved ended up pulling over. They got out of their cars, you know, exchanged information. They were going to take photos. And they were mortified to see Courtney's two young children unrestrained in the front passenger seat. Let me say that again. Her two children unrestrained in the front passenger seat. And in fact, they were covered in blood and they were just lying there unconscious across the center console. So any normal mom in this situation would be freaking out, right? Hysterical. You see your kids in this state. You're panicked. You're worried. You're completely just like distraught. Not Courtney. Oh no, not Courtney, because she just got out of her car and walked away from the scene of the crash. Just walked away. And when the police finally caught up to her, guess how far she was? She was about a mile away from the crash site. She was clearly intoxicated, and apparently she had this very relaxed demeanor, very slow, very deliberate movements, but her eyes were watery, they were completely bloodshot, her speech was all, you know, confused. So right away, it was obvious to the police that she was on something. I mean, heavily intoxicated. So they transported her to the hospital, and they ran some tests, and wouldn't you know it, they found marijuana and amphetamines in her system. Not to mention, she also didn't even have a valid driver's license. So she was arrested and she did post a $100,000 bond, and she posted this on the same day, which really pisses me off because I say it a lot, especially in cases that involved child neglect. But this woman's kids were found unconscious, lying across the center console, bloody. She abandoned them, yet she was set free the same very day. I mean, please make it make sense, because how is this even allowed? And this woman's two children are currently intubated at the St. Louis Hospital with life-threatening injuries, which breaks my heart into a million pieces. I literally cannot wrap my head around this case. I hope that these kids pull through, and more importantly, I pray that their mom is never allowed near them again. She is so reckless, so dangerous, and clearly a freaking selfish bitch. Sorry for me cussing, but like, how are you going to leave your children at a scene like that all to make sure your own well-being is intact, that you don't get busted, that you don't get arrested? It is so sickening. It really, really is. All right, so now let me give you the Diddy scoop, the deets on Diddy, because as we know, I already went through all of Monday and last Friday on the Tuesday episode. But now we are towards the end of the week and there's more to cover, because Cassie's mom testified. There were details released about his strict rules when it came to freak-offs. There were more photos, very graphic and disturbing photos shown. So let me break it all down for you. Now, as I mentioned in my last recap, what I found very interesting was that all last week, Diddy's family was there in court, sitting right there second row to support him, his mom, his kids, his sons, all of them. But Monday, nobody was in court, none of his family. Now, It's been said that there was some graduations going on and things like that that could explain the twins being away, could also even explain his mom not being in court. But then come Tuesday, they still weren't back in court. It was reportedly only his sister who was present in court. So my question when I talked about that on Tuesday was it because last week disturbed them so deeply and it was so upsetting that now they are withdrawing their support for him? I don't know, but it seems like a pretty bold move. I can understand why they didn't leave last week midweek because they didn't want to have some sort of uproar or that be the talk and the focus of everything. And then maybe just thought, you know, we figure next week, it's the start of a new week, we won't go. But we'll see if they start showing up as the week continues. But so far, apparently only his sister has shown up. So day 7 began with David James, the personal assistant to Diddy, back on the stand, and he was being questioned by the prosecution. And it was definitely more telling of specific events and his experience working for Diddy than what we briefly heard the day before. In regards to the relationship between Cassie and Diddy, David testified that while he never saw any physical violence between the two of them, he heard plenty of arguments. He recalled that the arguments were primarily over Cassie's career, too. That she would say that she wanted to branch out and do things like modeling and acting, but Diddy would just tell her, no, you have to focus on your music. And he claimed that this was often a reoccurring theme in their arguments. He also talked about his overall work experience with Diddy, talking about tasks, rules, and citing some specific moments too. So he talks about these overall terrible work conditions, and as we know, he had testified earlier this week that sometimes he would go weeks without a day off. And in this testimony, he said that the work was so demanding that he once had to go to the hospital because of dehydration. That was after working 24 hours straight. Now, a common phrase that he apparently learned from Diddy's security guards through all of this, I don't know if you would call it a phrase, a mantra, what, but it was, you know what rhymes with tired? Fired. Which is like, okay, cute for the rhyme, but also like, that's horrible. Like, talk about suing for working conditions, right? So he went on to testify about a time when Diddy apparently lost a Cartier bracelet during his short employment with him. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, Cartier bracelets are like the gold bands, the gold bangles you see often. They're like the love bracelets that have a lock. They have a ton of other jewelry too, but that's what they're known for. And so they're very expensive bracelets, don't get me wrong. But he said that once Diddy lost this bracelet, Diddy's security team apparently went through both he and his then-girlfriend's belongings, making sure they hadn't stolen it, that they weren't the ones responsible. Now, they didn't really give them permission to just rifle through their stuff, but he also said he felt like they couldn't really deny him, even though they wanted to, and even though they were innocent. Then, on two other occasions where something of Diddy's had come up missing, rather than look through David's stuff, he instead had David take a lie detector test, and he had these tests administered by somebody who claimed they used to work for the FBI. He described it as being very intimidating, which I can't imagine. That would, of course, be extremely intimidating. But apparently, this wasn't, you know, just a personal thing. Diddy had done it to at least one other employee that he knew of as well before. So it was kind of like a common thing for Diddy. He noted that neither one of his tests showed any sort of lies, discrepancies, none of that. So just truly an innocent employee. And this neurotic, power-hungry freakazoid was forcing him to take polygraph tests. Like, get a grip. Like, talk about paranoid, right? He also claimed that as his personal assistant, he was often the one in charge of getting him supplies for what we now know are the freak-offs. He testified that sometimes he was the one who was in charge of buying medications and snacks for the freak-offs too, which he says he would later be reimbursed for by Bad Boy Entertainment, the umbrella company. However, he said he knew that there was a set rule that if Diddy ever had him buy specific things like condoms, baby oil, or Astroglide, which is lube, that the reimbursement was strictly to come from cash that his security team was in charge of, and that that cash was in a Louis Vuitton duffel bag. Now, what's interesting about that is we referenced in the earlier testimony from this week that when the evidence was pulled out of one of the hotel rooms after one of these freak-offs, there was a Louis Vuitton fanny pack that had about $8,000 in cash. So I don't know if that was like a common occurrence where he always, of course, it seems like he always had cash on him, but that he was always paying for those kinds of materials in cash so that he didn't leave any sort of paper trail behind is my assumption. I don't know. But It is an interesting note. Now, this testimony was specifically important because it's eerily similar to the things that were listed in the December 2024 lawsuit against Diddy, and that lawsuit was again from another ex-personal assistant. This assistant's name is Philip Pines. He worked for Diddy from December 2019 to December 2021. Now, this lawsuit lists that Philip was the one who was told to set up the freak-off rooms, to like get the mood going, get everything right. So he had to set things up like red lights, ice buckets, alcohol, marijuana, joints, honey packs for male libido, baby oil, Astroglide, towels, illegal drugs, and what is also described as power banger sex machines. Now, look, I hope that nobody comes and looks at my Google history because I had to search what a power banger sex machine is. And what I found, can't guarantee it's the exact thing that he got, but it is what popped up when I searched it on Google. It's basically like a vibrating electric saddle, if that makes sense. It's like fixed to the ground, but it's like in the shape of a saddle. And you have, I would imagine, a woman sit on it. It vibrates to stimulate. And there's some that come with like all sorts of attachments and contractions so that there's objects that are thrusting and you know what I'm talking about, right? It's like you're sitting on like, imagine a horse, but it's not an actual horse. It's just the saddle and like the solid piece underneath the saddle. And it's a machine that you plug in and it vibrates, it moves, it like punches different objects into you and like very extreme. Very, you know, maybe I'm vanilla, but it just feels a little bit aggressive if I'm going to be honest. And it seems like maybe it was very similar things that David had experienced, but that as time progressed, as we see in so many different situations and crimes, it seems like maybe things escalated and that maybe it wasn't just good enough anymore to have lube and urination. He had to now spring for this freaking electric saddle because he wanted to get off and he was desensitized to all the other stuff. Who the heck knows? So as David is continuing to testify, he also states that he might have walked into the aftermath of a freak-off. It was Miami 2008, and Diddy had told David to bring him and Cassie their iPad to the hotel room. So he knocked on the door, nobody answered, so he let himself in with a key that he had. He claimed that Diddy was in the shower while Cassie was in the hotel bed asleep and had the comforter pulled up to her neck. He says he also saw a random man walking across the room. He said he never asked either one of them about it. He just figured, you know, it was, quote, personal things. So he thought maybe they were just into like some freaky consensual three-way. Maybe there was something else, but he just knew better than to ask about it. So after he wrapped up, Cassie's mom, Regina Ventura, was next on the stand. And she described that while Cassie was dating Diddy while in New York City, she had only seen her daughter 3 to 4 times a year. After Cassie moved to California with Diddy, she saw her even less frequently. And Regina just said, quote, it was harder to get to her, which is a huge red flag in very toxic, abusive relationships because we know there's like this huge element of isolation, grooming, you don't let them talk to anybody, you don't let them see anybody, and it seems like that is what was, at least allegedly, was happening here. So then, not too long into her testimony, the jury was shown photos of Cassie that her mother took of her. And Cassie was very bruised in these photos. They were from December 2011. Cassie had allegedly explained to her that Diddy had beaten her and that this was the first time she had actually admitted to her mother about Diddy being physically abusive toward her. Regina also noted that prior to learning this, she had read a tabloid about a celebrity getting beaten up in a car and that this tabloid had no names included in it. But she had asked Cassie if it was about her and Diddy, meaning she clearly had a lot of suspicions all throughout their relationship, if not at least the majority of it. And now Cassie was finally confirming to her how physical it truly was. Regina also spoke about a time how that same month in December 2011, Diddy threatened over an email that he was going to release a sex tape of Cassie. This is after he had figured out that she had been dating Kid Cudi. And we also know that there was like this huge threat where he like threatened to blow up his car as well. So he said the only way that he would not release the tape is if they paid him $20,000. Regina said that the only way that they were able to even make this work was by taking out a home equity loan. So he now was not only like extorting Cassie or like using blackmail and leverage over her, but also trying to extort her family. It's sick. So much so that they took out a home equity loan. Now, in regards to the threats to leak Cassie's sex tape, Regina was quoted on the stand by NBC News as saying, quote, I was physically sick. I did not understand it. The sex tape threw me. He was trying to hurt my daughter. And I think we briefly talked about this in the last update, but in case we didn't, I'm going to repeat myself here. He would also threaten Cassie with this. One time they were on a plane, a public commercial airplane, and he pulled up images and videos of one of their sexual encounters, one of their freak-offs, and was playing it for her right then and there, being like, if you don't comply with what I want and what I need, I'm going to release this. I'm going to show everybody. Just humiliating her and just really, again, blackmailing her. So her mom then also testified that there was one time where she called the police on Diddy. Apparently, Diddy and Cassie had gotten into a heated argument. He took Cassie's phone, refused to give it back, so Regina called the police. Eventually, though, he gave Cassie's phone back, and then he left with Cassie's car. Now, for whatever reason, the defense chose to not cross-examine her mother, Regina, which, I mean, thank goodness, this poor woman has probably gone through enough. So then the next witness that the prosecution called was an exotic dancer named Sheree Hayes. So Sheree describes the first freak-off that he was a part of, saying that it started in the fall of 2012. He testified that a woman who called herself Janet had reached out to him, saying it was her birthday, her husband had given her permission to hire him for the event, and that she wanted to, you know, bring him in. So he testified that going into it, he imagined that it would be just a performance for a small group of people, like an actual birthday party. He was told to go to the Trump International Hotel in New York, and he believed that he was only going to be doing this striptease dance for about 30 to 45 minutes max. Apparently, that's like the standard. However, once he got there, he says he found out he had gotten it all wrong. He said that the woman who answered the door was wearing both a robe and a wig. That's why he says he didn't recognize that it was Cassie at the time. She told him that she didn't want him to do a performance, but rather explained to him that she and her husband liked to create a, quote, sexy scene. So Cassie apparently briefly gave him the idea of what they wanted, as well as what the rules would be that needed to be followed. She said that it was all just having to do with the application of baby oil and that he just needed to follow her lead, that that's what it was about. All we need to do is just like rub on some baby oil, just like let me lead the way. She also said, most importantly, do not interact with my husband, which he now knows to be Diddy. He wasn't to look at him, speak to him, nothing. He testified that this, quote, sexy scene started by Cassie pouring the baby oil on herself. Then Sheree did it as well. At some point during that, Diddy then came into the room and he started watching them. He was given $800 when he first came to the room, and then he was given another $1,200 after creating that, quote, scene. After that incident, he was then hired by Cassie and Diddy again for similar interactions. In fact, he was estimated to have been hired between 8 to 12 more times after that. And the things that they would do allegedly would vary in nature, and his payments would, of course, vary as a reflection of that. They would vary from anywhere from $1,200 to $2,000, but he says that he still has absolutely no idea why. He says that most of the time, Diddy would just watch, kind of be like a little perv in the corner just watching. He would instruct Cassie here and there on things like, you know, switching angles, changing up the lighting, things like that, just trying to create the perfect visual for him. But he noted, very similar to what Cassie testified to, that each freak-off would last 2 to 3 days, that they would start around 2 or 3 a.m., and that they were primarily exclusively held in New York, and that they would go on for days. So again, his testimony as far as how long these freak-offs lasted, it definitely coincides with Cassie's testimony. He also testified that during that very first interaction, he never at any point realized who either one of them really were. He didn't recognize them until the second time that he went and met them. And the only reason he apparently even recognized them the second time around was because on the hotel TV, you know how at some hotels it has like a welcome message? It'll say like, for me, it's like, welcome, Mrs. Maestre. We hope you enjoy your stay. Well, at that hotel, the TV had a message that said, the Essex House would like to welcome Mr. Sean Combs. So right at that moment, it clicked with him who these people were, especially after later then going to Diddy's Instagram accounts and being a fan and recognizing Cassie in the pictures, realizing that's really Janet, she was just in a wig, and he put all of it together. Now, something really important to note is how he perceived Cassie's feelings on these events. He testified, quote, my understanding was we were creating a scene, a sexy scene, one that was enjoyable to her partner. He said that Cassie never refused any of Diddy's requests, but on more than one occasion, he did notice things such as a heavy sigh or a wince, and he perceived this as Cassie being frustrated. So not outright hearing her say no or that she didn't want to do it, but more like things like that, just like very uncomfortable. Now, that being said, he did clarify during cross-examination that he believed it was always consensual and that Cassie never seemed uncomfortable by any of it. Now, as far as drugs go, he testified that he personally never took drugs with either one of them, even though they apparently did offer him alcohol and weed multiple times. He testified that he never saw Diddy himself take any drugs either, and that Diddy never seemed to be intoxicated. And just to clarify, I don't know if he was asked if he ever witnessed Cassie take drugs or if she seemed intoxicated. It seemed like the focus was more on Diddy with that line of questioning. So then the next person to take the stand was Gerard Gannon, a special agent with Homeland Security Investigations. He previously had worked in the human trafficking group with HSI. So he was also the special agent that was in charge on the grounds of Diddy's Miami Beach home, the one that was raided back in March of 2024. Now, at first, he just spoke about smaller, more technical things about the raid, you know, like the agents who were waiting until Diddy left for a trip that he was scheduled to take that day, how they were just kind of like lying in wait, the size of the mansion, which, by the way, is about 20,000 square feet. And then he also talked about the task force that was needed, which consisted of approximately 80 to 90 agents. But then we got into more of the juicy details, because then the jury was shown a picture of the front gates of Diddy's Miami Beach mansion. And in this photo, it showed that the gates had completely just been like broken down so that they could gain access, which he noted that was standard practice. That's what we do when we conduct a search warrant, because it's the quickest and the safest option, which I've seen that in a million cases. They, you know, storm the castle, storm the door, storm the gates, whatever it is. Then the jury was shown pictures of items that were found in the master bedroom of the home. And some of these items included sex toys, lingerie, lube, baby oil, platform high heels, and then in a twist that's not really sexually related, upper and lower receivers of AR-15s. And these parts of the AR-15s were even shown on the stand in evidence bags. So this testimony continued, and also we learned that Kid Cudi himself is expected to take the stand at some point this week, which I want to clarify, after my last update, it was rumored that Aubrey O'Day, another member from Danity Kane, was going to testify. However, she did release earlier this week on a podcast that she is not testifying, so I just want to clear that up, because I was kind of going through the list of who's going to testify, who's not, and now we're hearing that Kid Cudi is expected to testify this week, so I'll keep you updated on that when my next update comes out, and we'll see who else is called. I also want to clarify, we had talked a lot about the prescription drugs that were found under the pseudonym Frank Black, and apparently that is a name that Diddy often used as an alias. So, just trying to give you all the updates as I get confirmation on things and as I learn things. Like I said, I will continue giving you guys these updates a couple of times a week, but they are outside of the normal release schedule, so make sure you're following the podcast or on YouTube so that you don't miss any of those. And I'm trying to keep it more like high level, the big takeaways, rather than getting into all of the nitty gritty, you know, nice to know but not need to know details. But I can always get more extensive if you want. So that is it for headline highlights. It's 6:30 p.m. I am heading to court bright and early tomorrow morning. So I will talk to you guys this Friday with my Karen Reed trial recap. But as always, for breaking cases, Diddy updates, Karen Reed updates, all case updates, it's better if you follow me on Instagram, which is @_AnnieElise, because I'm able to just hop on right there on my story and share it immediately. All right, guys, thank you so much for tuning into another episode, and I will be back on the mic with you very, very soon. Oh, last thing, I did see a comment. I forget where I saw the comment, but for my Friday episodes, not the Karen Reed recaps, but the bonus episodes that are like mini deep dives into other cases, you have access to those on Apple Podcasts and Patreon. I saw a comment where somebody was asking why those episodes are not being released while the Karen Reed recaps are being released, that they're bummed out. They are being released. I just want to confirm, we are still putting those out in addition to the Karen Reed recap every single Friday. So you may just need to refresh your Apple Podcast feed or your Patreon feed, but those are certainly still coming out. So, and for those of you who are not signed up for those, I don't know what you're waiting for. There's about 100 episodes you can unlock so that you can binge even more content. We have current cases we talk about, breaking cases, all sorts of cases on there. So you'll get access to that either on Apple Podcasts or on Patreon. But don't worry, we have not stopped doing those. They are still coming out like clockwork. All right, guys, thanks again. And until the next one, be nice. Don't kill people. Don't have any freak-offs, okay? Just don't do it. And just be a good person. All right? Bye.